It's time to talk about decolonising Australia. Join me, Rima Ratan, as I ask First Nations Australians about how they are decolonising and what settlers can do to help. Decolonising Australia, Monday nights at 6 p.m. on 3CR. Welcome to Decolonising Australia. This is a summer special on your favourite community radio station, 3CR. I'm Rima Ratan. Today I've got First Nations lawyer telling us about her efforts to decolonise the law. Tila Reid is a Wiradjuri and Welwyn woman from Western New South Wales. She's a lawyer and an activist. I spoke to Tila yesterday over the phone about her work, starting our conversation by asking her how she ended up becoming a lawyer.
I became a lawyer through kind of a long way, actually. I grew up in a small town in Western New South Wales. I didn't know any lawyers at all at the time. So I just was a natural sports person at school, a bit of a tomboy, and went in and did my undergraduate degree, was a double bachelor in teaching and health education. But it was, I guess, the last year of that degree where I was in Canada, or Turtle Island as some of them call it, and became more interested in law and politics back, and then postgraduate law degree. So it was a big kind of 180, really, in terms of career choices.
Was that a trigger?
Look, I've always grown up in an activist family. I think being out in Australia, one of the things that allows you to do is to reflect on your country and what's happening here, and I think that's a big year for me upon reflection. Then when I came back and I was a teacher, I was selected to go to the United Nations. That was the real big trigger. And we're seeing these systems working from an international perspective, but it made me also question, what can we do more back home to see and change in Indigenous affairs and First Nations communities? And I think, so that was the thing in terms of going overseas and then having the experience at the United Nations allowed me to think about, well, these international mechanisms are really important in terms of human rights issues. And at that time, it was the year that Australia suspended the Racial Discrimination Act to implement the Northern Territory Intervention. So it was profound year in terms of, wow, this is the impact of the law and the legal system and political decisions. And while we're here in international forums discussing it, how can we create more accountability in First Nations issues back home in Australia? So it really motivated me, being outside the country, to come back and go, what change can we create here for people at a community level? So, yeah, that really inspired me, that international experience.
When we spoke earlier, you mentioned three efforts that you're making in the law in particular to, I guess, make it more accommodating to First Nations lawyers. Can you tell us about those efforts?
The first thing started really early, particularly with my teaching experience, and at law school being such a law bubble, I really struggled at that period of time because there was no real cultural safe spaces for First Nations students to engage in legal arguments and develop our advocacy skills. So the first thing was setting up Australia's first First Nations mooting competition, which is where students engaged in a mock trial and a legal problem that they can argue and debate. And then, you know, a judge presides over that issue and decides which team wins. And so I thought what we need is culturally safe spaces for students to engage in legal issues that are affecting our communities. So that was the first thing that I decided to set up. And that, you know, it wasn't just me. It was lots of First Nations students who really believed in the idea and really wanted it to work, and it was a space that was needed.
The second one that you mentioned was...
One of the things that I have worked on since 2014 is establishing a Indigenous court model in New South Wales. It's called the Wallama Court. It's a hybrid of what we call in New South Wales the drug court, and then a hybrid of an Indigenous circle court. And I think that it's extremely important that we work to change these institutions and establish our own within these frameworks to ensure that the issues are dealt with in a culturally safe way, and that we're not just focused on, I guess, things like general deterrence, but we're also focused on diversion and rehabilitation and ensuring that people can reconnect to their country and their land. So the term Walama means to return, and that's what the court means, to return it to Indigenous peoples and Indigenous control. And I think, you know, it still has obviously a judge preside over it, but with the cultural authority of an elder or respected person sitting alongside that judge in a district court level in New South Wales. And it's been extremely hard work working on that model. We have developed it over time. We have a business case. We have crunched the numbers. I think one thing that I've learned throughout these processes is colonial systems don't like change. And if you are particularly First Nations trying to change these institutions or create your own, in the instance of the Walama Court and the Moot, change is hard work. The law is easy in terms of, you know, you can draft a model of a court. You can do the research on it. You can write it down. And what we have done is developed the Walama Court on paper. What is not easy is trying to convince those in political power to support this change and establish a court, because it requires legislational change, it requires institutional change, and
it requires people to change and give up power.
Absolutely, and it requires people, you're so right, to give up some power, but not necessarily to give up that power, but to say that First Nations peoples can govern their own affairs and be in control of their own affairs. And that's okay. You know, the world's not going to stop turning. Through the Walama Court in New South Wales, the proposal is to establish a court that will assist in reducing Indigenous incarceration through the inclusion of elders and respected persons in that process, where you might, you know, have a judge, you might have the defendant, you might even have the victim as well in a room who are having a conversation about, for example, the sentencing of the defendant. I think one of the things that the current courts don't do well is clearly articulate to the defendant the purpose of their sentencing. And through this court, what we're aiming to do is provide a safe space, provide a culturally relevant space as well, where people understand the purpose of why they're there, can be assisted then into the community to either engage in rehabilitation or reconnect with culture and identity, where they also feel supported in that community process, where we're trying to give them other options apart from prison. I think one of the scary statistics is that incarceration has increased rapidly since, particularly, for example, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and that this court is a step in addressing issues of recidivism and reducing incarceration. What we can't do is, right now, we're really struggling to convince particularly New South Wales state politicians that this is an idea worth investing in. It's frustrating because clearly the way in which courts are operating right now are not working. They're not delivering. You know, how is it that we are disproportionately incarcerated when we're only less than 3% of the population?
One of the phrases that keeps coming up in what you've said so far is culturally safe. Do you want to explain that a little bit more, if you can?
I think that, look, where there is elders, respected people, and a connection amongst the community or First Nations community, where they feel a sense of themselves in a process, that space can be created to connect them and to feel like they are supported. In, for example, the Moot was one where First Nations students were able to be supported and feel culturally safe with another First Nations mooter. That this court is a process where, you know, it's not just the judge talking at the defendant, but it's also they are supported by an elder and a respected person. I think one of the things that Western systems haven't done very well is to allow the culture of safety or come through in these institutions. And I think it could be as simple as using the language that we use, Aboriginal language. It could be as simple as making sure that they're allowed a support person in that court that's Aboriginal, understands where they come from, understands their story, and understands, you know, the process or the journey that a defendant or a victim as well might go on. And I just think that these are big, bold ideas, but they're absolutely worth doing. And I think through culturally safe spaces, it's not just First Nations who are able to benefit from it, but it's non-Aboriginal people who can learn to understand that they can be welcomed into these spaces if they respect our ways of doing.
And the changes you were saying about making it culturally safe, I kept thinking, you know, that would be something the law could do for domestic violence victims as well. That sort of creating a safer space, basically.
That's absolutely one of the contexts that we've spoken about in terms of this court addressing those kinds of issues. So right now, for example, I, as a lawyer in my day job, have done, for example, domestic violence list courts in the middle of Sydney. And look, those courts have lots of different kinds of defendants in them. But I guess one of the things that they don't do very well is create a safe space in the context of domestic violence where people can work through these issues. So, you know, you have the defendant very separate from the person in need of protection, and it's a very...
And the whole system is antagonistic, artificial. Isn't it, as well?
Yeah, because it's very artificial. Yeah, so that's absolutely one of the contexts we're looking at addressing, but also as well, you know, the fact that it's a hybrid of the drug court in New South Wales means that we are also trying to address these underlying issues that are contributing to people's behaviours. New South Wales has a very successful drug court system for all defendants. They go into a ballot and your name can get picked from a ballot, and it's open for everyone. What we're seeking is for that system to be a hybrid and to allow to include our elders and our respected people to have those culturally safe conversations. So it's not a big change, really. It's just simply trying to get this legislation passed and put through the state parliament, because it's going to need resources, and the legislation allows for it to be stable and secure.
You're listening to Decolonising Australia on 3CR, a short series that's part of our special summer programming. This is an interview I recorded with First Nations lawyer Teela Reid about her efforts towards decolonising the law. As a student, you created the First Nations Moot, and now you're working on the Wallama Court. But apart from that, you famously challenged then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull on Q&A about the Uluru Statement from the Heart. What was your involvement in the creation of the statement?
The way I look at my involvement is from very, very early stages. My grandfather taught me black politics very young. I was marched off to Lands Council meetings in my community. And just through my studies in law, I was invited, at the time I was working for a Supreme Court judge, to be involved in some meetings that prior to the Uluru Statement. And I didn't say much at all. It was my time to listen and learn from the elders. But I saw the hard work that was put in to this process. The hard work where people got up and they stood and they spoke about how they're survivors of massacres, how they're survivors of stolen generations, how they feel powerless in their communities because of youth suicides. And these are the issues that people spoke about when they gifted the Australian people the Uluru Statement from the Heart, a simple call for a First Nations voice to be entrenched in the Constitution and then to establish a Makarrata Commission to enable treaty and truth-telling. Now, I was one of the working group leaders on Section 5126, the race power of the Australian Constitution, at the Sydney Constitutional Dialogue. And that was really about, I guess, listening and learning on how we address this power. So Australia has a very draconian constitution that allows for the federal parliament to make laws not only to the benefit of First Nations peoples, but to the detriment of First Nations peoples, and that is a power written in the Constitution.
No, wait, just to pause for a second. So that power can be used against any race, as it were, but it only has ever been used in relation to First Nations people. Is that correct?
Precisely. The way in which the implementation of that law has been executed in Australia means it's only ever been used with respect to Indigenous peoples. And what we see is negative laws like the power for Parliament to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act and then to implement the Northern Territory intervention has not only those legal impacts, but it really has a psychological impact, I think.
Absolutely.
We have lived under this system of oppression. We've had the protection era. We've had the assimilation era. And I think we are really now at the peak of what we are calling the era of self-determination, where First Nations are going, look, we want to take power back into our own hands. And this means, this is not a threat to anyone, but it means having a say over the decisions that affect our lives. And I think that is the most simple but profound request at the heart of the call for a constitutionally entrenched voice. Surely this is only fair and reasonable. And when the Prime Minister at the time, Turnbull, dismissed it, I vividly recall getting a phone call to see if I wanted to ask him a question. And I thought, oh, no, not me, on Q&A that night. And then after work that day, I got a call saying, look, yep, you're confirmed, let's go on. And it's interesting because the person before me asked Turnbull a question about the Uluru Statement, but it was the question I asked that I think caused attention at the time. It was just why would he not support the call for it at the Uluru Statement from the heart? And he said something like, well, it would go up in flames. It's a third chamber. And I think that's such a dishonest and heartbreaking
but not response. Untypical response.
But I think we shouldn't just sit back and go, well, this is just the way it is. This is how typical they are. I think that's what fuels my advocacy right now, is people have, you know, can have a sense of complacency about the power they have to change this. The Uluru Statement was strategically gifted to the Australian people, not politicians, for this precise reason.
Yeah.
It has been, in the last 2.5 years, an epic journey persuading the people to support the Uluru Statement. But when people read it, people just think, this is just so simple and reasonable. Why have we not already done this?
Absolutely.
Australians feel so ashamed about, you know, learning about the, I guess, scars of their own system. And they want to do something. And I think absolutely the time is now for us to create this change. I'm feeling optimistic. We're going into 2020. Everyday Australians are walking with us on this journey. We will absolutely win this in my lifetime. It's going to happen. I have come from, you know, in my community, I have witnessed too many of my people die before their time. I refuse to let that happen to me and you know, my cousins and my nieces and nephews. I just think that they have to have some sense of hope that this system will change. And that also, in the broader scheme of things, that Australians want this to happen as well. I think that, you know, we have really, yes, I mean, we have built so much and lost so much. But right now, we have nothing else to lose. In 1967, the Australian people stood with us and they will stand with us again when it comes to fighting for a First Nations voice. Everyday Australians need to believe that they have the power to create this change, and every individual on this topic matters. I think that the conversation starts at people's dinner tables, it starts at their coffee tables, it starts in their book clubs, starts in their running groups. I think that we need to put this on the agenda. And if you look back in the last 2.5 years, Turnbull dismissed it. Morrison is now dismissing it. And the only people that are standing with us talking about it right now are the Australian people. I absolutely believe this will happen. We have an unfunded campaign and here we are still talking about it now. We've had absolutely no money.
Yeah.
And people want the change to happen. People should be writing to their local politicians. People should be ramping up this online campaign in support of the Uluru Statement. And people need to stand and fight for the entrenchment of it. It can only happen through the doubled majority vote, of course.
Quite early on in this conversation, you said that the law is an inherently colonial institution, which it clearly is. Would you then say that the work you're doing could be conceptualised as decolonising the law?
I absolutely do think, yeah. Part of everything I do is about decolonising this process and this system that has continually oppressed my people. It's about, you know, doing it pragmatically and strategically and bringing others along, particularly First Nations along, on this journey. Because I think the easy option is to say, this is too hard. We're going to get knocked back again. The harder option is to go, stand with me. Come, let's fight for this change. Let's set up the moot. Let's set up the court. Let's change the constitution. And I just think that I absolutely believe we are going to get this across the line, whether it takes 2 more years, 3 more years, or in, you know, 2020, we're going into the next decade. It will happen. This change is not easy. The fight is hard. The conversations are hard. But once the people have the right information, they clearly see that this is such a simple request. We have been travelling the country, convincing and just saying to people, set up your own group. Don't wait for us to come to your community. You have the power. You have permission through the invitation through the Uluru Statement to make this happen. Accept that invitation. Start to talk about this in your communities, because this is a country that we're trying to create and reimagine that is absolutely worth fighting for. And by the time I die, we're also going to be a republic.
Yes,
that's
we are.
My fourth thing.
I think we can't become a republic until we face our history anyway. I mean, it would be a lie, the reform, it seems to me.
Oh, totally.
At any rate. Yeah.
Totally, yeah. Totally. And I think there's a way in which we have to approach those issues.
But yeah. Well, just like the process of, I think it's Voice Treaty, isn't it?
Voice Treaty Truth.
I always thought maybe, yeah. don't we have to tell the truth before we can make a treaty? But anyway.
Lots of people say that. And I think one of the things is that we have to realise that truth-telling in Australia without structural change is status quo. We've had many forums for truth-telling, many commissions in the past, and they pump out recommendation or nice words on paper. What we need people to do is the most powerful truth-telling they can do is to recognise that First Nations were here first as a matter of law. Yeah. As a matter of fact and a matter of law. And that means doing the hard work.
What advice would you give to non-First Nations Australians about what they can do to decolonise?
Walk with us. Read the Uluru Statement. Share it. Accept that invitation and start to take action in your community, whether it's an individual level or a group level or a community level. Every action matters. Write to your politician. Sign up on social media. Join the journey that we're on right now. And don't get complacent about our future, because we do have the power to create the change.
Also, it's urgent. People are dying. It's time to do something about it.
The gap is not closing. Statistics are getting worse for First Nations. That we are still in a country where Aboriginal women are disproportionately locked up for unpaid fines. But not only that, in other jurisdictions, like Aboriginal women who are locked up are more likely also to be victims of domestic violence. You know, this vicious cycle is not going to end until we create these institutional changes that so desperately need to happen. Our youth are killing themselves at rates higher than before. These statistics are nothing to be proud of. In a country that is so wealthy, we can create the change that needs to happen. And I think we need to start to believe that we can do that. Lots of people think, oh, you know, it's the politicians who hold the power. They do not. They are accountable to us, and we need to be standing with and for First Nations communities. Look at 2020 next year. The government have committed almost $60 million to commemorating Captain Cook. That's so offensive to so many First Nations across this country, that there should be nothing to commemorate and celebrate when we still haven't addressed these fundamental issues of reckoning and truth about our history that is so skewed towards this colonial facade that I think you're right. It's not getting better for First Nations. It's getting worse, and change must happen. Be open to learning about really difficult things. These conversations are actually really hard. And you know what? The onus is not always on First Nations for truth-telling or decolonizing. The onus is also on our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters to stand with us and fight for the change that we desperately need.
You've been listening to Decolonising Australia on 3CR. That was Teela Reid telling me about what she's doing to decolonise the law and what you can do to help. A special thanks to Teela for making time on Sunday morning during her holidays to speak to me. And in fact, a thanks to all the guests on this show. It's a difficult, busy time of year, and I'm deeply appreciative, as I'm sure as our listeners, that they're giving time to us. That's it from me this week. Tune in again next Monday at 6 p.m. to hear more about how we can decolonise Australia together. We're going out with a song chosen by Teela, as it happens. This is Tracy Chapman with Talking About a Revolution.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, run, run. But a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Oh no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. For more information and to donate online, go to 3cr.org.au. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.